Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 25th of June. Our guest this hour is the author of a fascinating and important book, I'd say, Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller, Oil and the End of Globalization. Our guest says one way to reduce the amount of oil we need to keep the economy running is to make your world smaller, and that is exactly what is going to happen. Our guest, Jeff Rubin, is the former chief economist for 20 years at CIBC World Markets and one of the first economists to accurately predict soaring oil prices back in the year 2000. He is now sought after regularly to talk about energy. He's a regular guest on CNBC and CNBN, I believe it is. He's consistently been sounding the alarm on peak oil. Chief oil, the lifeblood of the global economy, and yet this is an era, he says, that will soon come to an end. So we're going to talk about all of that this hour and a lot of different aspects, transportation and flying and food and how we make things and where we make things, all of that up for discussion this hour. And we'll welcome phone calls. We'll be flooded. I know this is one of your favorite topics. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Very good, thanks.
Good. So you start the book with the story of the salmon, and it is, you know, it is an amazing story where this fish goes before it winds up on our plate.
That's right. And, you know, I mean, what the salmon has become is just a ball bearing or a microprocessor, just another commodity that's shipped around the world. I guess the good news is that a lot of people get to eat salmon who otherwise would never have ever tasted a salmon. The bad news is that those diets are probably unsustainable in the future because of the just enormous amount of energy and in particular oil that is required for the salmon to circumnavigate the world from being caught off the coast of Norway to being processed in China and then sent back across the Pacific to North American supermarkets.
Yeah, and what a journey, isn't it? It's just an incredible story. You would have thought that somebody, and I know they have when oil prices were really high, but eventually somebody's going to think, wait a second, we can't afford to do this anymore.
Right, and of course it's not just salmon, because that's just illustrative of a more general phenomena, which has been the exponential increase in distance between farm gate to supermarket. I mean, you know, today it's an average of 2,000 to 3,000 miles, and of course, you know, what it's done is it's allowed us to change our diets and it's allowed us to, you know, access food from all around the world. But the energy trail requiring for that is ultimately unsustainable, and what it will reverse is the trend of us becoming more and more import dependent on food.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what's happened. We're so weird in this country. I remember the gas lines back in the 70s when we were concerned about oil prices and shortages. You write early in the book about August of 2008, which was not very long ago when oil prices peaked and we changed our habits pretty dramatically. Tell me what's happened since then and how we're bound to return not only to August of 2008, but oil prices much, much higher than that.
Well, of course, what's happened the most dramatically is where we consume the most oil, and where we consume the most oil in North America is right on the road. About, 60% of all the oil consumed is consumed as diesel, gasoline, or jet fuel. And, of course, what we've seen is the U.S. auto market collapse from, you know, roughly 16, 17 million units to about 8 to 9 million units. And that's, of course, the power of $4 a gallon gasoline. And I think one of the things that we're going to see is that while there will ultimately be an economic recovery, there will be no recovery for Detroit or the auto industry, because a recovery will be very much a double-edged sword. It will bring back the financial wherewithal for people to buy cars, but of course it will quickly pushed gasoline prices to where it was only two Memorial Day weekends ago, $4 a gallon and even higher. And at those prices, the North American highways will become more and more looking like West European highways, and they have very different vehicles and a lot less vehicles.
Mm-hmm. So we're in this sort of double-edged sword here. As the economy gets better, the oil prices are lower because the economy isn't doing great, but as soon as the economy gets a little bit better,
pump prices are affordable only because we can't afford to drive. We're in a recession. Not only a recession, the deepest recession in the entire post-war period, not only in the U.S. economy, but in virtually every major oil-consuming economy in the world. And still, in the midst of this recession, you know, oil prices are just under $70 a barrel. Well, you know, roll the clock back 4 to 5 years ago, and today's depressed oil price, what you see when no one can afford to drive, would have been an all-time record high just 4 to 5 years ago. So the paradox here being, you know, pump prices are only affordable when you can't afford to fill up. When you have a job and you can't afford to fill up, guess what? Pump prices are heading back to $4 a gallon and probably in a couple of years, $7 a gallon. And that means that probably one out of every five North American drivers are going to be taking the exit lane over the next decade.
$7 a gallon, you say, in a couple of years.
That's right. And if you want to know what American roadways will look like at $7 a gallon, all you got to do is look at German or UK or France's roadways, because those folk have been paying the equivalent of those prices for over a decade because of fuel taxes. And what you find there is, A, you know, GM produces the second most appealing popular car in Europe, called the Opel Astra. You couldn't give that car away in North America because it was viewed as too underpowered. And secondly, that car ownership is significantly lower than in North America. If we were to adopt Western European car ownership rates, as I say, probably about one in five vehicles would be getting off the road. So that's, you know, that's roughly about 50 million vehicles in the next 10 years. I guess the question is going to be, is there going to be a bust to get on?
Yeah.
In Western Europe, there is. In North America, right now, there isn't.
Well, why is it that we fight this? We certainly have had premonitions of this and a reality of this, you know, some years ago. And then 20 years later, we're building huge SUVs and great big vans that get no gas mileage. We're eating salmon, you know, that makes this journey that costs forever. It costs a whole lot of money in terms of oil consumption to get to our plate. We have a very hard time, it seems to me, in this country making any significant changes. Are we going to wait until that $7 comes and then we're all going to collapse?
I suspect we will, because not only are we not making those kind of changes, but we're investing billions of dollars of taxpayers' money to prop up an auto industry that's doomed to obsolescence by triple-digit oil prices. Mm. I mean, if we're going to go into record deficits like we seem to be doing, let's at least invest in our future, not our past. It's public transit that we ought to be investing billions of dollars in, so that when 50 million Americans do take the exit lane, there is a bus to get on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I think that right now we've just gone through a huge misallocation of public spending, propping up, as I say, an industry that is unlikely ever to recover.
Let's move into the food industry for a while. A couple of years from now, we may no longer be eating that salmon. Maybe we ought to consider at this point whether or not we should be eating it right now. Not only salmon, but we're looking at all kinds of foods. The way we eat, you say, will be quite different.
That's right. And, you know, I mean, last year, the United States imported over $6 billion of food from China, bringing a whole new meaning to having your Chinese food delivered. I mean, everything from bok chow to frozen chicken wings. And that not only requires oil to move the boat, but also for refrigeration. That won't be tenable in the world that I see. When I was a boy growing up in Toronto, you didn't see blueberries and raspberries and avocados in the supermarket. supermarket in January and February, and I suspect you won't see them in supermarkets in Wisconsin in 4 to 5 years, because simply the amount of oil required to get you that produce will make that avocado salad too expensive in January, February. So it's not, of course, like we won't eat, but we're going to have to become more self-reliant, and we're going to have to reverse what has been a common trend throughout North America, which is that we grow less and less of our own food. Well, that's going to have to reverse. It's also going to require a change in diets. But one of the essential requirements for us to grow our more food is basically to reallocate the land to agriculture. And I think where triple-digit oil prices will lead us, where market forces will lead us in a world of triple-digit oil prices, is that some of those far-flung suburbs will be ultimately reconverted back into the farmland that they were only 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, I wonder, do you know what the statistics are on those McMansions? Because they're so far from cities, and they must cost one heck of a lot to be able to heat. I'm sure the resale is very, very difficult in this particular time. Are a lot of them just empty at this time?
As a matter of fact, many of them are. First gutted by the subprime mortgage crisis, and now to be gutted by oil. Because don't forget, the whole notion of the far-flung suburbs and exurbs is based on cheap energy. It's based on being able to commute 30, 40 miles a day from work to where you live. And, you know, that's just not going to be sustainable in a world of $4 to $7 a gallon gas. Gasoline. So what's going to happen is that people are going to move from those far-flung suburbs back into the inner cities, and real estate value in those far-flung suburbs is going to start to fall, while at the same time food prices is soaring. So the intersection of those two trends is that over time it's going to be more economic to take some of those developments and convert it back into farmland, because people aren't going to be buying homes 40 to 50 miles from where they work.
We're getting food, though, on this huge level from all over the world, all these frozen foods, etc. If we return to more land for agriculture here, how are we going to be able to feed all of us? Because we have these mass production methods now.
Well, I mean, we're going to have to, I mean, we're not going to be able to have the same kind of diets as we have right now. I mean, back in the office tower that I used to work in, you know, you could go down to the food court and there would be everything from sushi to Tex-Mex to Indonesian to, you know, Polynesian to even the bottled water came from some black forest in southwest Germany. That's just, you know, that's just not going to be there. We're, of course, going to have food in our food court. But as I say, I think the diets are going to go resemble more the diets that we had as kids or the diets of our parents, because we're just not going to be able to fly things in like we do today. And the other, of course, issue with food is how much food is dependent on energy costs. Because when you really think of modern agriculture today, modern agriculture is really transforming hydrocarbons into food. You know, where does the fertilizer come from? What powers the irrigation system? What powers the tractor? And what we're seeing is we've been applying more and more energy per acre of land to get food yields up. And is that going to be possible with the kind of energy prices that lie around the corner?
What's going to happen with countries like China, Jeff? You talk about the fact that they're bringing several coal-fired plants online every week. They're using a lot of energy, and in order to achieve a standard of living that we've had that maybe nobody should have anymore, how are they going to survive?
I think China will do quite fine, because, you know, I mean, everybody is going back to a smaller world. Everybody is going back to their own domestic market. And China's domestic market is a huge domestic market. Just look at autos, for example. It's already surpassed the U.S. vehicle market and will probably leave it in its dust. Now, you mentioned coal plants. Where I talk about coal plants with China is just to underscore the absurdity of North America or Western Europe closing its coal plants when China is building 800 coal plants. I'm not at all suggesting it's absurd for North America to want to close coal plants to reduce CO2 emissions, but how almost quixotic it is when China's free to do that. And while we can't stop China from building 800 coal plants, because after all, that's how we industrialized, what we can do is make sure that cheap, dirty energy is not used as an unfair trade subsidy, so that we, when we put a price on our carbon emissions, as I think is imminent in the United States, we have the right to apply a tariff against goods coming into our country that are powered by, powered by industries that don't pay for their carbon emissions.
Two phone calls. We have many of them coming in. We're talking this hour with the author of Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller, Oil and the End of Globalization. Jeff Rubin is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Jeff, and let's start with Jim from Prentice. Hi, Jim.
Oh, is that myself?
That's you, Jim.
Okay, I'm having a little trouble hearing. I'd like to have make two major points. Perhaps it'll sound like I'm disagreeing with your guest, but it might just be that it's for different reasons. My first point is I believe in the future that the price of food will radically increase in the United States, but I don't necessarily think it's related very much to the price of oil. I think what is going to happen instead is that the American federal government has been extremely irresponsible, and in order to float our huge deficits over the years, we've sold over $1.5 trillion of United States government bonds to China. In other words, they've loaned us all that money. China is a country with over 2 billion people. All they need to have is a bad harvest. You know, it might be a drought year, it might be insects, a pest, it might be a blight of some kind. And then China can go into the international food market and directly bid against American food consumers with that $1.5 trillion American dollars they're already holding. And it looks like this president administration is going to increase that to, God, I don't even know, maybe $2 trillion. That's my first point.
All right, why don't we do one at a time, or we'll have so many points.
Okay. Well, let me respond to that, because there is no question that China has been the single largest holder of U.S. Treasury bonds, which is, of course, what is paying for this record-sized deficit. Now, let's understand why China is doing that, because it's not an act of benevolence to U.S. taxpayers. It's done to support its export industries, because if China didn't show up at the Treasury auction and buy all those U.S. Treasury bonds, then the value of the Chinese yuan would soar against the U.S. dollar, and Chinese exporters would be hurt by that. Now, I don't think that China's going to actually have the same kind of appetite for treasury bonds in the future, because in a world of triple-digit oil prices, the U.S. market is not going to be a natural market for China to export. That China's wage advantage in so many things, from steel to food, is going to be more than offset by the transport costs of shipping things to faraway places like North America. So that as Walmart becomes less and less important to Chinese producers, they're going to allow the Chinese yuan to appreciate more and more, and they're less likely to show up at the Treasury auctions, which means that you and I will ultimately have to be buying those bonds, and that suggests to me that interest rates will be significantly higher in the future.
All right. Get to number two, Jim.
Well, my number two point is that in the long run, I probably agree with your guest that fuel prices will be very high. But John Maynard Keynes says we're all going to be dead in the long run. I'm much more concerned about the short run. And I think I heard on the BBC last night that in this huge stimulus package from the Obama administration, it's going to the states and the cities. You know, Wisconsin, just little Wisconsin, has got over, I don't know, $4 billion or so of this money, that the Obama administration inserted a Buy America provision inside this legislation somehow. And what that tells me is that we're possibly going to have a repeat of what happened with the Smoot-Hawley tariffs in the 1930s. Our European trading partners aren't stupid. And when they figure this out, they're going to start erecting trade barriers to goods made in America.
All right, let me hold you there. We have a lot of callers. Jeff?
I couldn't agree more that Buy American procurement in so much of the public stimulus right now is going to be repeated among America's trading partners in places like Canada, in places like Western Europe, in places like Japan, in places like Australia, where everybody is relying on government to prop up their economy. Government spending has never played a more important role, and now government spending will be biased to buying domestic production. That's going to mean that, as I say, our theme is that the world's going to get smaller. We're going to go back to localized economies where the domestic market has become much more important. I'm not a proponent of this form of protectionism, but I think your caller is absolutely right that once America starts doing it, it's naive to assume that America's trading partners won't be doing it just as soon.
Jim, thanks very much for your call. We go to Pete next from La Crosse. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Kathleen and Jeff. Hey, as we have oil and natural gas for mobility, we might actually get smarter as far as using the sun to replace that oil and gas when it comes to heating our homes and supplying us with hot water. I'm wondering if any of your calculations have shown what would widespread adoption of solar thermal technologies provide us as far as an extension of the oil-powered world as we know it.
Well, in places like Denmark and Germany, which incidentally are very hydrocarbon poor places, but they're world leaders in renewables, in wind and solar, they're talking maybe as getting as much as 20% of their total energy needs. Of course, you know, the question is what happens when it's not, the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing. I certainly think that these sources of power are going to become more important and more economic as the price of oil rises. History has shown that in a world of triple-digit oil prices, ultimately that world will incent the development of non-carbon forms of energy. But I guess the point of my book is that our rendezvous with triple-digit oil prices isn't in 15 or 20 years where we might develop these new technologies. Our rendezvous with triple-digit oil prices is probably within the next 12 months. And in the here and now, the onus is going to have to be on reducing our oil demand as opposed to developing alternative sources of energy that don't require oil. And that the single most important thing we can do so that peak oil doesn't become peak GDP is go from a model of the global economy where we're moving things around all around the world to a model of the local economy, because in the global economy, whether we're moving things around by plane, by boat, by truck, or by rail, we're burning oil. Mm-hmm. So again, it's not that over time we won't develop alternative forms of energy, but in the here and now, I think the onus of adjustment is going to be on the demand for energy as opposed to the supply of energy.
Thanks very much for the call. The thing that keeps running through my mind, too, Jeff, is why didn't we learn? Why haven't we learned from what we've already been through? So we should have been ready to go now.
Well, because, this runs counter to what we've been taught. In economics, one of the, principal assumptions of economics is the upward sloping supply curve, which is just a fancy way of saying the higher the price, the more of something should be supplied. And indeed, after the OPEC oil shocks, textbook economics worked. We found Prudhoe Bay in Alaska. We found North Sea oil. In other words, the price shock from the OPEC shocks stimulated the development of new sources of low-cost oil. That's not happening anymore. I mean, the places that we're now looking for oil are like 5 miles under the ocean floor, or they're trapped in tar sands mm-hmm. or shale. And, yes, triple-digit oil prices can pull 4 million barrels a day of production out of the Canadian oil sands, but the kind of prices that you're going to need to make that economics work, is going to translate into $4 to $7 a gallon gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that we're running out of oil in any absolute geological sense. As I say, there's about 165 billion barrels of oil trapped in the Alberta oil sands. But for Alberta ever to become a Saudi Arabia, you know, that implies prices that we can't afford. So what we've really run out of is the oil that we can afford to burn.
I know you do a lot of speaking, and you warned about upcoming very high oil prices to groups of people in business. Well, you've done it all over the world, but in Canada too, and people just didn't want to hear what you had to say. Who are you speaking to now, and what are they saying about what you're saying?
Well, it's funny because the people who didn't want to listen to it were, in fact, the very people who were the greatest beneficiaries, because back in 2000, the Canadian oil sands, for example, required huge government subsidies for anyone to be remotely interested, and now, according to the U.S. Department of Energy, this is probably the single largest source of new oil in the next 20 years. But the people I'm speaking to now and the people that I wrote this book for aren't oil company executives like I was speaking to 10 years ago, but rather, you know, people who, everyday people who, you know, who have to, who are going to have to adjust to this, because at the end of the day, you know, being able to reduce our demand for oil isn't about the Federal Reserve Board and it isn't about the U.S. Treasury. It's about every single American and the decisions that they make every day in their lives about where they eat, what they drive, where they work. And that's to whom this book is written. And I think, you know, one of the things that I'm trying to illustrate is that, you know, quite apart from just filling up your tank, so much of our entire economy and our lives have been predicated on cheap oil, things that we just take for granted. And, you know, I think one of the reasons people are so reluctant to accept the fact that we've run out of affordable oil is because of the huge changes that it implies. It's much more convenient to think that this is just because of gouging by oil companies or the actions of rogue speculators, because then we lull ourselves into the complacency that we don't have to change.
Renee from Cornell, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I couldn't have fallen at a better time in this conversation. I live in central Wisconsin, north central Wisconsin. I commute 50 miles to go to college. I did that as a single parent in order to better my life. I don't have other options. I have downsized my vehicle to the point that if we travel anywhere, most of my family doesn't all fit in the car along with my things. We don't travel. I don't go on vacation just because I don't have the finances to do that. But we out here, in the middle of nowhere, feel very, very trapped and frustrated with the situation. I can't cut back anymore. I have worked up a plan with other families to do commuting for my kids to go to sports events and things, and our local school system is doing so poorly that they are talking about consolidating with other school districts, which would involve increasing my drive up to 20 to 25 miles one way. And so just as a rural, and I know farmers in this area feel the strain of this, you know, the increase in gas prices. And so it's just a really deep frustration for us who live out here. And, I mean, it would be easy to say, well, I could move closer to Eau Claire's, the local biggest city. But I grew up here. I grew up in this community. My kids go to this school. You know, their dad lives within 10 miles of me, and I'm not willing to make that change. And maybe that makes me selfish in some sense, but it also, I live in America, and I want to stay where I am. And so, I mean, maybe if the guests could just comment on you know, what they expect us to do out here in, you know, in rural America, where we don't have the options to take a busing system or a transit system, you know.
Okay.
It's just a frustration.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I think what I'm saying is that it's going to become more and more difficult to live that kind of lifestyle. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's going to become more and more difficult. The only silver lining I can see here is that most people who live in the rural areas, not everyone, but most people who live in the rural areas are going to be in some way involved in agriculture and farming. And I think that food prices are going to be going up very, very significantly in the very near future. And that, of course, is going to translate into better incomes for farmers. Whether that's going to, you know, offset all of the costs that that your caller has just mentioned, I you know, it's difficult to say, but there's no question that for most people it's going to become increasingly unaffordable to live out in the far-flung suburbs, and that we're going to see, I think, in the next decade or so, a move back to rising urban densities that will reverse really the whole post-war period of suburban sprawl.
Mm-hmm. And all of those suburban areas, some of them are, well, I guess the ones that are fairly close to cities may thrive. Those that are farther and farther away may not.
That's right. That's right. And I guess the question is going to be, there's going to be two questions. I mean, one question is going to be, do we have the public infrastructure to handle the increased population in the cities, particularly if they're going to be abandoning to some extent their cars and relying more and more on public transit? And secondly, are the cities going to be zoned properly to accommodate this rising urban density? Because right now, probably the cities could not absorb all of the sprawling population in the suburbs. So I think there's going to have to be some pretty significant changes in the way that cities are designed if they're going to be able to efficiently absorb this movement of people.
Thanks, Renee, for your call. We go next to Dan from Wausau. Hi, Dan. Hey, Dan.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
I had a comment. Can you hold one second? I had a comment. You keep asking how we got here, and I would just point out that Jimmy Carter had started a lot of renewable energy ideas and thoughts moving in the country. Ronald Reagan's first official act when he took office was to order the solar panels removed from the White House. His campaign was largely funded by the oil industry, and I myself just became certified as a renewable energy installer. But I know a little bit of the history, and under Reagan, there was a vicious campaign waged against renewable energy on behalf of the oil companies, and in excess of 90% of all renewable energy companies were bankrupted during Ronald Reagan's tenure in the White House. It was vicious and it was intentional.
Jeff.
Well, you know, I'm not going to exonerate the Reagan administration or, for that matter, any other administration. But, you know, as an economist, I believe in the power of prices more than the power of politicians. I think the key reason that we ignored renewables and that we continue to rely so much on oil was the fact that we had cheap oil prices. And by the same logic, I'm pretty confident that when we see triple-digit oil prices, we will change radically. We will change radically simply because we will have no other alternative but to change. When, you know, 50 million Americans all of a sudden ditch their cars and find that there's no bus to get on, they'll quickly get their politicians' attention and make sure that money is diverted from bailing out Detroit to building public transit vehicles. So, again, yes, I don't think that Washington has been particularly far looking in its approach, but ultimately the actions they took had to do with the cheapness of oil. We were in a world of cheap oil, and I think that world is pretty well over.
Mm-hmm. How's the renewable energy business going, Dan? Dan is gone. I hope it's going well, Dan. Pat from Chicago is next. Hi, Pat.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to ask a question about one of your previous callers said regarding the Obama administration supporting Buy America. If my recollection is correct, the Obama administration itself was actually against that and worked to get it reduced in the compromise with the Republicans. And it was mainly the Democrats in Congress who, you know, for their talking points, wanted to, you know, support America through more engine Buy America. Do either of you know if my recollection is correct? Just in the idea of being accurate and trying to get things straight of who says who, because there is so much information floating around.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think one of the issues here is that while the federal government has been certainly a lot less guilty of blatant Buy America provisions, what happens is that federal monies that get handed down to the local government level, it's at the local government level where domestic procurement is very strong. And I don't think this is really a partisan issue between Democrat and Republican. I think this is more a federal versus local. But I'll just point out that when, you know, everything from sewer systems to roads becomes buy local, it's only natural that, you know, America's trading partners in similar economic conditions with similar huge roles of government spending respond in kind. And then before you know it, you know, all of a sudden everybody's doing it. What makes it particularly threatening is that government spending today in the U.S., in Canada, in the U.K. is much larger in its role in the economy than it normally would be because of the importance of these stimulus packages. So that means that if these stimulus packages do indeed discriminate against imports, that that's going to be a larger and larger barrier to trade, given how important these government subsidy stimulus packages are in these economies.
Thank you. Keep up the great work now.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pat, very much for the call. Can we spend a minute talking about coffee? I know you love coffee. I like coffee as well. And that where we get our coffee and where we're likely to get our coffee, it's a fairly big business and a big part of a lot of people's lives right now. Talk about where it's coming from and how that will change.
Where I talked about coffee was not just the coffee, but the whole notion of the barista economy, you know, that everybody's working at Starbucks now. And I'm just pointing out that if we're going to start making our own steel and we're going to start making our own flat-screen TVs and we're going to start growing more of our own food, not everybody can be working at Starbucks in the service sector. We're going to need more and more people to be working in manufacturing and agriculture, and that the trend towards, you know, a shrinking goods sector and an ever-expanding service sector is about to stop dead in its tracks and about to reverse. You know, as for coffee, I mean, the coffee's always imported, but the server is always local, and we're still going to import our coffee. I suspect that we're going to probably drink less coffee, and I suspect that we're probably going to go back to the old corner coffee and donut shop as opposed to pay $3.25 for a double latte at Starbucks.
Jeff Rubin is our guest. His book is Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller, Oil and the End of Globalization. He was the chief economist at CIBC World Markets for almost 20 years and one of the first economists to accurately predict soaring oil prices back in 2000. He lives in Toronto, and he's talking about how our lives are going to change pretty dramatically as a result of high oil prices, and they're bound to be with us again, and then some, in just a couple of years. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Couple lines are open for you, 800-486-8655, or you can also send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. We go next to Jim from Pleasant Prairie. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Such a huge, fascinating topic with so many tentacles, so to speak. It's a shame that we only have 1 hour to cover it. Comment I was going to make is that I am very much in agreement with the guest in terms of short-term projections. But hopefully, I mean, we've obviously become much too dependent on oil and the automobile, and there's going to be major adjustment pains coming. But in the same time, I'm more optimistic about the long term, because as oil is today's and yesterday's economy, tomorrow's economy is more likely to be much more nuclear-powered and hopefully clean coal. And hopefully, could the guest comment on that.
I absolutely agree. I mean, whether it's clean coal or nuclear or something that we haven't yet developed, it's clear that triple-digit oil prices will incent us to develop a post-carbon economy that won't be powered on oil. And I think that if you look at economic history, one can be reasonably confident that such technologies will emerge. But again, it's a question of timing. You know, we're probably still a couple of decades away from that occurring. We've got to deal with triple-digit oil prices in the here and now, or very shortly in the here and now. And that I think that, you know, in order to deal with that now, we've got to find a way of reducing the demand for energy so that peak affordable oil does not equal peak GDP, because if it does, then, you know, this recession is permanent. And I don't think that it has to. No question that over the long run, the answer is going to be in finding new forms of supply. I'd like to point out, however, that, you know, in the short run, where we go back to local economies as a way of spending less on energy, there are going to be more than a few silver linings here. I mean, we're probably going to see a lot of industries that we thought were gone forever, industries such as U.S. steel, all of a sudden become revitalized, because it's not going to pay to export steel from China to the U.S. when bunker fuel is going to cost $100 a barrel. So we may find that even in the short run, our economies will become more diversified. We won't just be working in the service sector, that our manufacturing sector certainly will be a major beneficiary, because in a world of triple-digit oil prices, distance will cost money, so much so that not everything will simply be made in the place where wages cost the least.
Mm-hmm. And somebody earlier brought up stimulus money and the amount of money that was coming to Wisconsin and other states, Jeff. Do you see any of that money, and as much as we need, to work on startup businesses, to look at converting, you know, our energy supply, to look at green energy, et cetera?
Well, unfortunately, where, you know, a huge chunk of that money is going is to prop up Detroit, which, you know, I mean, I fully understand the need to support unemployed workers in the auto. But I also know that in World War II, Detroit turned itself from producing cars into producing tanks and planes. Why couldn't Detroit transform itself into producing public transit vehicles? That's what we really need. So unfortunately, very little of this stimulus money is really going in the areas that a world of triple-digit oil prices will require.
Thanks, Jim, very much for your call. Frank from Madison is next. Hello, Frank.
Hello.
Hi, Frank.
Very, very fine guest. I was wondering to what degree the crisis, you know, of peak oil and the realization of the genuine costs, which has been a long time coming, of an oil economy represents an opportunity to bring about the reduction in CO2 production that's causing climate change. So, and that is a greater emergency than we generally imagine, and the changes necessary to bring that about are greater than we find comfortable. So as the price goes up, is it the of oil goes up, I'm afraid we might be lured into believing in clean coal and the proposition that CO2 sequestration works, and so we might stay on a carbon economy too long, both to introduce the alternative technologies and to do something about the accumulation of CO2 in a timely fashion. And the calculations for adapting are that it would be somewhere between 2% and 4% of global GDP to make a conversion, and that's a pretty good investment against the future. So that was a question to your guest. Are we looking at an opportunity, and is he optimistic? Thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Bye.
Well, there's no question in my mind that, you know, one of the silver linings of triple-digit oil prices is the potential of a lot greener economy. I mean, triple-digit oil prices will do more to halt CO2 emissions than 100 Kyotos, because if you don't burn oil, if you don't burn hydrocarbons, you're not emitting any emissions. I think, you know, down the road that what we really need to do is put a price on carbon emissions. And I'm pretty confident that the Obama administration is going to do that. I think even more significant, when America puts a price on carbon emissions, it's going to raise the bar for its trading partners, whether it likes it or not, because, well, you know, Americans aren't going to pay for their carbon emissions and then let other people sell them goods and not pay for their emissions. So I think they'll be raising the bar for everybody. But there's no question that triple-digit oil prices is going to make it more difficult for us to burn oil. That's got to be a plus on the carbon front. Your guest mentioned carbon coal sequestration, which is basically capturing the emissions from burning coal. You know, for that to become economically viable, you need the price of emissions to be about $60 to $70 a ton. So in addition to triple-digit oil prices, what we need to do in addition is put a price on coal emissions, on CO2 emissions, as they've done in Western Europe. And as I say, I'm pretty hopeful that Washington's going to go forward in that area.
I'm wondering, is Canada dealing with all of this better than the United States is? Are you more enlightened than we are?
Not at all. Not at all. Au contraire. the image of Canada being a greener economy is probably a stereotype, but one that is not really backed by history. Typically, what happens is that state legislation in the United States leads the way. Then the EPA comes in and adopts the state legislation at the federal level, and then with another lag, it's adopted by the Canadians. And as I say, if you put a price on your CO2 emissions, you'll be raising the bar for your trading partners, and certainly Canada's your largest trading partner. You would soon see the Canadian government follow suit with putting a price on emissions in Canada as well. And that's a good thing, because mm-hmm. if we're concerned about CO2 emissions, we have to understand that this is a global problem, and we need all governments involved in this. But certainly the U.S. putting a price on CO2 emissions would be raising the bar for everybody.
Thanks, Frank, as always, for your great questions. Let's go next to Joe from Beloit. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good morning. I was just curious. I realize your host has made, or guest has made, excellent points about food and transportation, but another very energy-intensive industry is producing the processors that go into computers and then using those. So I was wondering what impact oil is going to have on those high-end electronics and bringing the silicon together and all the products that go into electronics.
Excellent question. The amount of oil involved in producing a chip is absolutely staggering. And when you think of it, countries like Korea, South Korea, that are, you know, world leaders in exporting chips, actually implicitly import a tremendous amount of oil in being able to produce those chips. It's going to filter through. I mean, the price of oil is going to filter in through everything. And at the same time, however, by virtue of looking at things as an economist, because I'm a macroeconomist by training, when the price of oil starts to filter through everything, it's going to change our behavior, because it's going to force us to develop new technologies to use less oil, and that is certainly going to be true of chips and integrated circuits. But I think your caller's right on there. I mean, that's as energy intensive as any industry in the world. I focus on food because you know, it's even more of a head fake, because if you look, you know, at sort of, you know, your image of the green farm gate, it's really a hydrocarbon industry as much as any in the world. But certainly the same can very much be said about producing chips.
Are you doing something different on a daily basis after absorbing yourself in all these issues?
Well, I'm not working for an investment bank for openers.
Right.
That's quite a change. I'm certainly hanging around my own local neighborhood that I have lived in for 18 years, but discovered that I really didn't know that well, because as the chief economist of an investment bank, you don't spend a whole lot of time in your local neighborhood. I am beginning to change, and again, I think that these changes are going to occur not necessarily because people come to this position philosophically or because they have a certain set of principles, but I think we're all going to go back to local economies because at the end of the day, it's going to be the only thing that makes economic sense in the world that I'm talking about. And you know, I mean, we're going to have to give up things. I mean, when I was a university student, I would go trekking in Kashmir, or, you know, maybe go to Chiang Mai, and now we're going to have to spend more time in our local environments. But I think the silver lining here is that the more time we spend in our local environments and the more time we get to know our local environments, probably the better places those environments will be to live in.
Thanks, Jeff. You were great. Jeff Rubin, Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller, Oil and the End of Globalization. It has just been published by Random House. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the hour. And thanks to Rob Schroeder and Jalema Noel for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Thanks for listening, everybody.